Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable James Case Folt presiding with the Honorables Cale Miller and Anthony Navarro. You may be seated.
Welcome to Division 2 of the Court of Appeals, Council and Parties. We have two cases set for oral argument this afternoon. People versus Perez. It appears Council or President Reddy in that case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Very good, thank you. And Mitchell versus Regents of the University of Colorado. Council President Reddy in that case.
Yes, you're ready.
Yes, Your Honor.
Very good. We'll take that case second. Thank you both. I'm sure that most of you have argued before us. For those who may not have, let me simply review the ground rules. These cases are set for 15 minutes aside. You'll be guided by a lighting system, which works as follows. When your time begins, the green light comes on. After 10 minutes have expired, the yellow light will come on. And when your full 15 minutes have expired, the amber or the red light will come on, rather, signaling you to complete your argument. We are recording and videotaping your arguments today. So if there is any confidential information or information of a sensitive nature that you do not wish to have disclosed, tailor your arguments accordingly. We've read your briefs. We're familiar with the facts as you set them forth. So to the extent you wish to proceed directly to your legal argument, that's fine with us. Even so, the case is yours to argue as you wish. We would ask counsel, since we're here on an educational basis as well, to take about two or three minutes at the beginning of your presentation, turn around and face the audience and give them a brief recap of the case as you see it. That time will not be counted against you in your 15 minutes. And hopefully that will give the students an opportunity to hear what the case is about for those that may not have read the briefs. We would also invite counsel to stay after the arguments to talk to the students about their arguments and the briefs that they've prepared. We find that when you do that, the students have a lot of intelligent questions for you, and I think it's very beneficial for them and also for you. After we have finished both cases, we will go into the chambers area for about 15 or 20 minutes while the students can question the attorneys. And after that, we will come back out and be happy to answer questions from the students, not about the outcome of the case, of course, but about our process, how things work, what we do, brief writing, presentation of oral argument, and the like. So with that, we're ready for argument, Mr. Hare.
Hi, I'm Andrew Hare. I'm a lawyer with the Public Defender's Office. I represent Eduardo Perez. Mr. Perez is appealing his conviction for identity theft as a Class 4 felony and criminal impersonation as a Class 6 felony. Basically, some basic facts are that Mr. Perez worked for, over about a six-year period of time, some fast food restaurants. And at each of these restaurants, and one in particular, which is the focus of this particular case, he had supplied his name, his address, his phone number. So they were identifying information that was him. He was not representing himself to be somebody he wasn't. In addition to that, he provided a social security number. And in this particular case, there's a Xerox copy of that particular card that he presented. That number, in basic terms, ended up belonging to, or belonged to, not him. It belongs to a woman, Sandra Guillen. And in essence, this number came to light because Ms. Guillen was receiving benefits from the state and was under scrutiny because, in addition to that, it appeared as though she was receiving funds through work, which she was not supposed to be doing. Mr. Perez was basically approached by authorities, as well authorities went to his place of business, and these charges resulted from his use of that social security number. And so this case basically focuses on his use of that number, what does that mean, and also the question in terms of criminal impersonation, his use of that number, and what does that mean in terms of legal capacity. So in general terms, that's kind of where we are here today.
Thank you, Mr. Hare. Counsel, you wish to proceed and talk about your side of the case?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
Hi, I'm Ken McReynolds. I work with the Colorado Attorney General's Office. And a lot of what Andy said is accurate as far as what the factual scenario was, is that his client had used a social security number belonging to a Broomfield woman for employment purposes for about 6 years. And I don't think I'd call Dave's Barbecue a fast food restaurant, but had a series of restaurants. And what the case, how the case came to attention was because the victim here had her benefits potentially being taken away and was possibly going to be punished for fraudulently taking benefits for unemployment when she was having wages reported under her Social Security number. But it wasn't her that was doing, who was reporting those wages or receiving those wages. It was actually Mr. Perez. As far as the legal issues, really what this case comes down to is sufficiency of the evidence. The jury was instructed correctly on the law and received the evidence that was presented and concluded that he was guilty of both charges. The appeal here is basically questioning whether or not there was enough evidence for the jury to reach that conclusion.
Thank you, Mr. McReynolds. Go ahead, Mr. Hare.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Andrew Hare on behalf of Eduardo Perez. I intend to address the identity theft conviction, focusing on the particular elements of knowingly using the personal identifying information of another, and then the next element involving with the intent to obtain cash or a thing of value. After that, I intend to move to the criminal impersonation conviction and address the question of knowingly assuming the false or fictitious legal capacity to obtain a benefit through use of this particular Social Security number. I've recounted some of the facts. I don't intend to go over those again. Basically, the essential thrust of the state's case is that the Social Security number, because Mr. Perez received remuneration for his labor and continued to receive payments, that he would have necessarily known that this number belonged to someone. That is to say that it was a valid number that actually belonged to someone. There are several problems with that particular inference or that particular assertion. First, with respect to verification of a Social Security number, and really I think Flores-Figueroa from the Supreme Court is at least instructive with regard to Justice Breyer's discussion of really what's going on when an immigrant submits paperwork, which in this case included a Social Security number. In terms of verification, if the number belongs to someone and the corporate management or the government checks and it doesn't belong to the individual, then they don't get to work. If the number that they submit is fake, in essence, it doesn't belong to anyone, and there is verification by corporate management or the government, and they find out, they don't work. So it doesn't matter. There isn't any, whether it belongs to someone or it doesn't. If there's actually checking involved, which I would assert that there really wasn't, at least in respect to the manager who testified regarding how payroll services ostensibly work with famous Dave's Barbecue, it's dubious at best, but also it actually reflects that it's not accurate in terms of the kind of verification that's necessary. Secondly, you can't assign to Mr. Perez knowledge of payroll services, how payroll services work. There's no evidence that he has any idea how famous Dave's works in terms of payroll services and the like. But the point with regard to verification and so forth is that for all the state's argument about how he should have known that this belonged to someone because it worked, it actually reflects at best that they either aren't checking, they aren't verifying, they're doing a poor job, as I think that the manager's testimony reflects, because he simply says, our payroll services only accept valid numbers. Well, numbers are assigned to individuals. This individual is a female, Ms. Guillen. If the actual verification that's expected and supposed to be done, it's immediately known that it doesn't work. And if it weren't a number that were actually assigned to an individual and they actually tried to verify it, it wouldn't work. He doesn't get to work. That's why Justice Breyer spends an entire paragraph talking about, well, ultimately, does the person who submitted this even care? Probably not. There's certainly no evidence that Mr. Perez cared. He submitted the number. He got to work. They accepted his application. They allowed him to work.
So the argument, as I understand it, Mr. Hare, is that if this was a fictitious number and Mr. Perez had no knowledge one way or the other, then he can't be guilty of identity theft under this particular statute.
I think whether it belongs to somebody or doesn't, what it reflects is you can't assign knowledge to an individual, whether it belongs to somebody or doesn't, unless it's verified that it does belong to somebody or it doesn't belong to somebody.
And that has to be done by the individual charged with the crime, or at least has to be imputed to him?
Well, Justice Breyer discusses the difficulty necessarily kind of attached to this particular issue in Social Security numbers. And the problem is there other documentation? For example, were there to be documentation that Mr. Perez had wireless phone bills or Excel bills or the actual card that Ms. Guillen, her Social Security card, something that would indicate actual knowledge of this person's identifying information. But in this particular instance, we have the use of a number, and the use of it and the fact that he gets paid simply reflects that if we're to believe that there is actually a verification process, that people are looking the other way, they're doing it poorly, or they're just not doing it. But that doesn't mean that Mr. Perez himself would necessarily know. Now you can infer beyond a reasonable doubt that he knows that this number belongs to anyone. And Justice Breyer, I think, ably explains that that simply isn't the case, but then goes on to give examples of classic scenarios in which someone would be probably guilty of knowing use of someone's personal identifying information. When they're dumpster diving, they find a credit card, they go to the ATM or they go to the bank, they try to withdraw funds, they hack into a computer, they access personal identifying information and they use that information. There's some connection, there's some knowledge of the use of that particular information. We simply don't have that here.
Is there any evidence, Mr. Hare, in the record regarding how the defendant selected this particular number?
There's absolutely none. There isn't an indication where this number came from, how it was accessed. It was used apparently over a series of years at different fast food places, and that's all we know. We don't know where it came from. And as I indicated earlier, the Xerox copy of the card doesn't indicate its source or where it came from or anything of the like.
And was it used at restaurants at which he was not employed?
It seems to be, the record seems to reflect that it was used at places where he was employed. He was hired and worked and received remuneration for his work. If the court has no further questions about that particular element, I'd like to move on to the next element in the identity theft statute at issue here, which is with the intent to obtain cash or anything of value. Mr. Perez asserts that Beck is on point, basically. I understand the court does not, as a different division, have to follow that, but it obviously provides excellent rationale and reasoning and interpretation of this particular statute. The Latin phrase eustem generis basically meaning of the same kind. The court reviewed the identity theft statute with respect to the things, the items that are at issue in terms of potentially being stolen or used in terms of benefiting the offender. And the last phrase, thing of value, the court said, well, we're going to look at those items, those particulars that are referenced immediately preceding it, and they have to be of the same kind because they're not, this statute is not referencing and basically adopting the language of the thing of value definition that is provided more generally in general terms earlier in the criminal code.
Excuse me, is it your position that the statute is ambiguous?
No, not at all. I don't believe it's ambiguous. I think that applying a known and applicable interpretive tool to this particular phrase, acknowledging, reading the statute as a whole and reading in context with the other thing of value statute, recognizing that it's different, it does not contain the same items that are in the more general category of thing of value. And so I don't think it's ambiguous. I think it's applying a correct interpretive tool that gives life to the identity theft statute in its particular and narrow to the kind of crime that this particular statute is addressing, which is generally almost exclusively designed and directed at pecuniary interests and things of economic value. And that's what Beck, the court in Beck basically held, that all of the items that are listed in the statute are addressed to things of pecuniary value, economic value. And they held that in that particular case, the issue with regard to driver's license and the ability to drive, to access basically someone else's driving record, was of a non-pecuniary nature. The same is true here. Mr. Perez wanted a job, he applied for it, he got it. The job itself, as I've indicated in the briefs, it perhaps has an intrinsic value, everybody wants a job, but it doesn't have a pecuniary value as this statute is directed at. There was no unjust enrichment. He worked and he was paid. He got paid for what he did. There was
Counsel, can I follow up on that point? Is your position that the benefits of the job that were important to your client were not the pecuniary benefits? There were some other non-pecuniary benefits, which is what he intended when he took the job?
Well, I think it takes one step at a time. That the use of the Social Security number is in an effort to obtain it. It has to be supplied. That's obviously what is going on when one applies for it. For purposes of obtaining the job, having the opportunity to work, that's non-pecuniary in nature. And so in terms of the benefits I think Your Honor's talking of, in terms of the cash value or the economic value to him, that only comes later after he has performed services.
So it's your position that a job is not a thing of pecuniary value?
No, it is not, Your Honor.
He wanted the job for some other reason, not because of pecuniary benefits?
Well, I think he wanted the job ultimately to work to then get paid for his work. But I think the first step has to be that he has to obviously apply and be and successfully satisfy his employers. And I don't believe that the use of that particular Social Security number is with that particular intent in mind for purposes of obtaining the job.
Okay. Well, for purposes of that argument, then we have to compartmentalize a job and separate that from the benefits that flow from the job. Does that make sense in terms of statutory interpretation?
Well, I think I think it does make sense in terms of statutory interpretation, because the essence is he must apply, he must satisfy his employers that he's acceptable for the position. Again, the notion, the other inference I think Your Honor is, and the state is perhaps pushing, is that there is some unjust enrichment here as a result of the use of use of this particular Social Security number. But the enrichment that Mr. Perez is realizing is with respect to the work that he's performing. And so there isn't anything unjust or, we assert, illegal or condemnable in that regard. And so that particular distinction is valid also, as I said, with respect to the items that are listed. It would not work if a statute referenced motor vehicles, tractors, and the like, and said cars and trucks and so forth, and then said motor vehicles. It would not, using this particular statutory interpretation, it would not include airplanes or helicopters. I guess my point trying to be is that if jobs themselves do not fit within those things of the same kind that are listed immediately preceding the thing of value. I see my time has almost expired. I'd like to reserve the remaining 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Very good, thank you.
Good afternoon, may it please the court. Kevin McReynolds, 40978. I'll address the same issues that defense counsel chose to address here. Number two, with regard to identity theft, whether or not the evidence was sufficient for a rational juror to conclude that there was, in fact, knowledge on the part of the defendant that this was a valid Social Security number that belonged to somebody.
Before you get to that, counsel, I just want to make sure I understand your argument. You don't dispute the fact that the element of knowingly applies to the fact that the number belonged to another, that the people had to prove that the defendant knew the number belonged to another person. You agree with that statement of the law?
I actually do disagree with that, Your Honor, but we assume for the sake of argument that that was true because that was the construction below by the trial court. And frankly, this is not a very close case. It's a sufficiency of the evidence case. We believe that the evidence was more than sufficient for the rational fact finder to come to the conclusion they did here. And this is not a case in which we need to do the statutory interpretation of whether or not the reasoning of Flores-Figueroa should be implied against the Colorado identity theft statute. And I actually think there's some very good reasons as to why it should not.
But you haven't given us any of those reasons in your briefing, right?
You're correct, Your Honor. It was not an issue that was briefed because this is a sufficiency of evidence case. It has a very deferential standard of review because of the deference owed to juries in making their conclusions. And here the jury was instructed that that was an element. The parties argued to the jury as to whether or not that particular element was met. And so for the sake of this case, it should be decided narrowly on the issue that is actually here, which is whether or not the evidence presented was actually sufficient for that to make that conclusion. And here the evidence was more than sufficient because what we have here is an individual who used Social Security number that belonged to somebody else on every W-4 form he filed for years, for every piece of employment he did for years. And we had testimony by the famous Dave's manager saying, basically, if it's a counterfeit number, if it's a random 9-digit number, payroll systems won't accept it. And this isn't an E-Verify case. This isn't a case about whether or not employers should be checking names against Social Security numbers. That's actually what came up in Flores-Figueroa, which is why he was caught on the first instance of using somebody else's Social Security number and did not have that, could not be found to have that kind of knowledge that it was a real number because he didn't use it successfully for a number of years. Here we have the opposite situation where this number got rejected, did not get rejected by payroll because it was a good number. It was a valid number, it belonged to a human being. And that's what makes this case a lot different, is that when you fill out a W-4 form under penalty of perjury, you're signing a document saying, do my tax withholdings, this is my number, this is what it's to be associated with. And every time he received a paycheck, he had deductions taken out of that paycheck that were being sent to these Sandringuean's taxes. And what that shows is that after he was using it, after he saw it was a valid number, he saw it was belonging to an actual human being. And it's not a question.
Well, aren't you imputing, Mr. McReynolds, that the defendant knew all of the background involved in employment verification and Social Security verification? Well, I mean, as I understand your argument, it is that, well, this number worked, and he must have known that.
He did know that the number worked, and I think it's interesting the fact that it's actually a Colorado number. The odds of him making it up randomly and it being a Colorado number is rather large. But more to your point of what we're presuming, all we're asking is that basically what defendant's position is that the prosecution had to disprove his ignorance of the law. It's an IRS legal requirement, as discussed in the Weber case cited in the answer brief at page 24, that it is an IRS legal requirement that you have a valid Social Security number to work in this country. It is not an employer requirement. And to accept the defendant's argument here, where there is evidence that he knew it was a valid number because it was using it repeatedly, the only way you could disprove that would be to catch him red-handed, pulling the card out of Ms. Guillen's purse, or to prove that he was not ignorant of the law. And that's just not a burden that the courts generally, that the law imposes on prosecutors. What we have to prove is that there's enough evidence here, and again, this is a sufficiency evidence case, that there's enough evidence here, enough circumstantial evidence of that mens rea for a jury to rationally conclude that that element was met. And the state's position is that there was more than sufficient evidence for that for that conclusion.
As I recall Flores Figueroa, the defendant there worked successfully for 6 years without a valid Social Security number, did he not?
I am recalling that he used a counterfeit number. I don't know the specifics of why that was not caught as the for payroll purposes.
Doesn't that disprove your argument to some extent that if the that the number in Flores Figueroa was valid?
Well, there were two different numbers used in Flores Figueroa. The first is what you're discussing is a counterfeit number. The point that he was caught on and that the aggravated identity theft interpretation of it, which was a sentence enhancement statute, was going to when he used a real number and a real legal permanent resident card number that did not belong to him. And those were caught on the first instance. When he provided those new numbers to his employer, the employer checked with ICE, they bounced back as not matching him, and that was what he was being prosecuted for in Flores Figueroa. I can't speak to what the factual scenario was regarding the use of the counterfeit number back in the year 2000 until 2006. What we have here is a Social Security number that was used between 2004 and 2008.
Was there any evidence from any of the witnesses that the prosecution called that said that you have to have a valid number in order for this not to kick back immediately?
Yes, Your Honor. And that was what the manager of the Famous Dave did testify to. Our payroll system will not accept a counterfeit number. Our payroll system will only accept, and you can only get paid if you provide a valid Social Security number.
So let's take it one step further. How did the defendant know that?
Again, this would be requiring the prosecution to disprove his knowledge of the law, because
it's an element of the offense. You have to prove knowing that it is of another. So not saying that it's the prosecution doesn't have to disprove ignorance of the law. It's the prosecution must affirmatively show some evidence that he was aware that this belonged to someone else.
And I think that part of that evidence would be the circumstantial evidence that he used this number at every employer he had and knew that it worked successfully. And he knew that you needed something to help you get there. He knew, he is deemed to know what the law is, and the law is you must have a valid Social Security number to work in the United States. And given that that is a legal requirement in order to work, it was not unreasonable for the jury to infer from that he knew what he was doing, that he knew that this was a valid number, that he knew every time he got a paycheck that was deducting money out of that paycheck that it was going to someone, probably the someone whose Social Security number he'd filled out in his tax withholdings on the W-4, which was also in evidence. I'm going to turn very briefly to the question of the pecuniary benefit. While I don't think the court needs to reach the issue, I don't believe that Beck was decided correctly for the reasons set forth in the brief. Basically, the legislature put forth its definition of what thing of value was to mean, and provided that unless we say otherwise or the context dictates otherwise, that should be the interpretation, that should be the definition of that. And the Beck court essentially turned that on its head by saying, well, because the identity theft statute didn't specifically reference that definition, that instead we will look to see, compare the two and see which is not like the other and where the redundancies are not, and came to the conclusion that pecuniary benefits was what was required under the identity theft statute.
I wanted to get back to your point that he is deemed to know that a valid Social Security number is necessary to work in the U.S. And your authority for that is the Weber or Weber case?
The Weber case is a case that shows the point to the fact that it is a legal requirement of the IRS that you have a valid Social Security number, not an employer requirement. It's not something that's imposed by, you know, by different parties. It's a legal requirement.
Anything else in the record or?
I attached for the court's convenience legal authority, which was the employer's guide, which is basically a common sense guide published by the IRS regarding what the requirements are for employers in correctly doing their payroll And one of those requirements is that you have to have not an individual taxpayer identification, which immigrants can have for other tax purposes. You have to have a Social Security number for employment purposes. And that is also in that authority.
I'm looking at your discussion of the Weber case on page 24 of your brief. The parenthetical you give is that case holds the IRS whether the employer imposes the legal requirement that employees furnish Social Security numbers in order to obtain employment. You don't say a valid Social Security number. You say give numbers, which is what anybody could do. Did that case distinguish between a Social Security number and a fictitious Social Security number?
That case went to a very different issue, Your Honor. It was really about whether a individual who wanted to work without providing a Social Security number at all, because he had religious objections to having a Social Security number. It did not speak to the question of valid or invalid. We do know from the testimony of the manager that an invalid or counterfeit number is kicked back by the IRS and payroll services, because when you go to make those...
Well, we know that because we've heard the testimony, we read the testimony. But why was the defendant supposed to know that, about how Famous Dave's payroll system works?
Well, again, I think there are a number of different pieces of circumstantial evidence that we can use to reasonably infer his mens rea. Included among those things are the fact that he knew this was a valuable enough number to go out and have a card made. He knew that it was a number he could use successfully to work with not just Famous Dave's payroll system, but any payroll system, because it was a valid number. And he knew that taxes were being deducted out of his paycheck based on the number that he had provided. It's not irrational or unreasonable for the jury to conclude from those facts that he knew that that number belonged to somebody. He knew that that money was going to something associated with someone. And you're right, we don't have direct proof of it, but we have what we usually have in cases of trying to prove mens rea of a defendant who doesn't testify, which is, what are the reasonable inferences we can make from the circumstantial evidence we have?
Is there evidence that the, I don't know the answer to this, does the defendant speak English?
I believe he speaks English, but I don't know because that wasn't in the record and he did not testify.
And is there anything in the record that indicates he can read English?
I don't believe there's anything in the record specifically. I do know that he according to the record, he'd filled out his employment information, he'd filled out his employee application for Famous Dave's. If I could turn just very, very quickly to the criminal impersonation cause of action. Because it is a legal requirement to supply a Social Security number in order to work, really, because false capacity doesn't require showing that the number belongs to anybody, that's really the distinction between the two statutes, is whether or not there's a victim or not. Identity theft was created in 2006 because of basically a new style of crime. And what the legislature differentiated between that and criminal impersonation, which was on the books, was the distinction between whether or not that number belonged to somebody else, whether it was a false fictitious number as opposed to a number that actually belonged to a human being. And we're not disputing that that is an element. I just don't fully agree, and we don't need to reach for the purposes of this case, whether or not the defendant must know that it is of another person. But again, going back to the criminal impersonation, this is one of a very narrow set of cases that's going to actually be decided under Montes Rodriguez, because about 6 months later, the legislature amended the statute and essentially wrote it out of existence. But this case is bound by it, and what the Supreme Court's decision was based on was whether or not it was a legal capacity, whether you needed that information, the personally identifying information you supplied, in order to legally get what you were doing, whether you were assuming a legal fitness or capacity. And this case is very different from Montes Rodriguez, because in that case it involved applying for a car loan. And the court found that you did not need a Social Security number in order to legally obtain a car loan. It's obviously very difficult.
Mr. McReynolds, your time unfortunately has long expired. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. First, with regard to the assertion that Mr. Perez is presumed or basically being held strictly liable to know the law with regard to Social Security numbers, I think Montes Rodriguez is at least helpful in terms of the overlap regarding what's going on with mens rea. In that particular case, they held that evidence was insufficient because the prosecution presented no evidence regarding the applicability of Social Security numbers, how it operates, what reference it has to one's legal status or legal ability to work. There's no evidence of that in this particular case. That's why I, in the reply brief, would ask the court not to rely upon the state's citation to and reliance upon federal authorities that were not presented to the jury and actually not evidence in the case regarding the operation effect of Social Security numbers and one's presumption to know that they that one needs one when one applies. Again, it gets back to the Your Honor, Judge Casebolt, regarding Flores-Figueroa. That's true. The individual in that case, Mr. Flores-Figueroa, worked for 6 years with a counterfeit number. It defeats the state's argument. The notion that you have to know that the number belongs to a person because you submit a Social Security number and you're able to work. What you do know, the best that you can infer, is that they're not checking, they're doing a poor job, or they're looking the other way. And that's certainly possible in this case because he was an exemplary worker. That's what the witnesses testified to.
Counsel, yeah. Can I take you back really quickly to the impersonation conviction?
Sure.
The people seem to be relying on the notion that the defendant assumed a false capacity, the legal capacity to obtain employment. And they also point to the testimony from the manager at Famous Dave's that their payroll system would reject a fictitious Social Security number. Why isn't that evidence that the defendant had to assume that capacity in order to get a job and to get paid for it?
Well, in Montes Rodriguez, again, there's no evidence regarding the operation and effect of a Social Security number. In terms of assuming one the legal capacity, I would add that one of the issues is they originally charged Mr. Perez with assuming the legal capacity of Sandra Guillen. They basically amended that, asked to amend it, remove it from consideration by the jury because they couldn't prove it. In terms of legal capacity and the Social Security number, you, again, I would assert that the court cannot assume or present and presume onto Mr. Perez what the manager was relating with regard to the operation of the payroll services. That he didn't know that. There isn't any evidence that he knew it. When he submitted the Social Security number, he's not acting in the capacity of anybody but himself. He's not assuming a false or fictitious capacity. He's simply applying for a job. He knows he has to submit 9 numbers. He did. They said, we want you to work. And so I hope that answers your question. And I have nothing further. The court has no further questions. I'd ask the court to vacate the convictions.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course. Why don't counsel go ahead and set up on the next case, if you would, and Mr. Hare and Mr. McReynolds, if you would like to stay and have the time to do so, we would appreciate that, but you're certainly not required to.
I think there's going to be a recess so they can talk to the audience. Is that going to not happen?
That's going to happen after the second case.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Weldon and Ms. Gill, we'd like to offer you the same opportunity to take a moment and talk to the audience and give them a brief two-minute overview of the case as you see it. And then, Mr. Temple, if you wish to respond, that would be great as well. Go ahead.
I can do that. Thanks so much.
I'm Charlie Weldon. I represent the appellant. And I'm going to say a little bit of preface of facts when I start, so I don't want to repeat that. But by way of overview, my client, I've heard many times, is the Director of Environmental Health and Safety at the University of Colorado. So it's a little ironic that we're here. But he was at UC Denver, and the problem dealt with what was happening at the Anschutz campus in Aurora. And by way of overview, essentially what he had to do was, as regards the radiation safety program, he had to replace a position that he felt was necessary for safety, and it was also mandated by the state oversight regulatory body. So the problem was is that his superior wouldn't authorize funding for the position. And the university promised they'd fill it, and notice of violation was issued. So he figured out a way to go around his superior, his supervisor, to a committee, which then got the chancellor of the university to mandate that the position be filled. His supervisor told him, you're going to regret that. And a year later, he was terminated. So in that level of a position where you're, and this will be important in a second, you're an exempt employee instead of a classified within the state personnel system, he has unique vulnerability. So now he's terminated from that position, and he's filed a lawsuit to recover. It's hard to get another job because of that stigma that attracts to that. So you have some substantial economic loss. So he had a claim against the university under the whistleblower statute. Now, I'm going to give you two things to watch for that I remember from my first year in law school. One of them was that your job is to read these cases and sort out what the holding was, as opposed to everything else that the judges said in the opinion. And that's one of the things that you'll see us dealing with here. The Lloyd case, what value does that have to our situation here? And you'll hear me talk about that. What was the holding and what was dicta in the case? The other thing that you might watch for pertinent to what you're doing is I remember the facts when I was first year law student. And I learned an important lesson that I'm applying here today. Because I gave an oral argument, mock oral argument, and there was critique and all that. And I had two things to argue in that oral argument. I could argue that that statute was unconstitutional. I really wanted to grab that because I was excited by that. Or I had a second argument that, well, I can sort of, we can harmonize these and we can make it fit and we can all go home and it'll all be okay. Well, the lesson I learned was go the other way. Don't fight the constitutionality first. That's a backup position. Take the easier road and try to convince people that it's best to harmonize the statutes that they conflict so that they don't become unconstitutional. So you'll see that come up here because one of the arguments that follows is if we don't do this right, then Mr. Mitchell, as the exempt employee, doesn't get the same protection as the other employees protected under the whistleblower statute as classified employees. So that's somewhat of an overview. I'll talk a little bit about the facts when I start as well.
Thank you, Mr. Weldon. Mr. Temple.
Hi, I'm David Temple. I'm an attorney for the University of Colorado. And I don't agree with pretty much everything Mr. Weldon said about the facts of this case. It's kind of how this game goes. But the facts really don't matter. What this case involves is the interplay between what's going to be called the Whistleblower Act, technically the State Employee Protection Act, and the Colorado Government Immunity Act, which I'm going to call the Immunity Act. So the Whistleblower Act protects employees who are whistleblowers. As you heard, Mr. Weldon arguing that his client was a whistleblower. We don't agree, but again, that's not relevant to this appeal. The second act is the Colorado Government Immunity Act. The Immunity Act essentially is a law which limits the governments, including the universities, including local governments, whether fire district, what have you, limits their liability in tort. And that's a public policy decision that's been made by the legislature. For some torts, you can't sue government entities at all. For some, you can, but there's a cap of $150,000. So, what happened in the trial court was that there were several claims against an individual defendant as well as the university All the claims were dismissed as against the individual. All the claims were dismissed against the university except one, and that's the Whistleblower Act claim. Once that happened, we filed a motion with the trial court asking for permission to essentially give Mr. Mitchell $150,000 cap and moot the case, so we wouldn't have to then go through a protracted trial. And we hoped an appeal, but here we are. So we filed that motion. The trial court agreed. We turned over the money, and the court dismissed the case as moot. And so here we are. Mr. Mitchell has raised two arguments on appeal. The first is that the cap in the Immunity Act shouldn't apply to whistleblower claims. And the second is that if it does, that it violates constitutional equal protection because it treats professional exempt employees, which is what he was, differently than it treats classified employees, which make up most of the state employees. So that's what the case is.
Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Weldon.
May it please the court, counsel. And Ms. Gill is here with me today as my co-counsel. Mr. and Mrs. Mitchell are here as well. The Anschutz Medical Campus gets more than $500 million annually from the federal government to conduct cutting-edge experimental research in areas that involve biological issues, chemical issues, and radiation issues. What came up here in the context of Mr. Mitchell's concerns as the Director of Environmental Health and Safety was a radiation issue, because the campus uses research irradiators with radioactive isotopes against with animals and other biological materials. And the risk attendant to that is, of, among other things, a leak event. So there's a radiation department that has historically involved and is mandated by the state two radiation safety officers. And again, like I say, the state mandates this. The state licenses the irradiators, one of which involves a cesium-137 radiation processor, and regulates it and monitors it, in fact, in a secret way that's not available to the public. So the state is heavily involved in this through what council said, the CDPHE, Colorado Department of Health, Safety, Environment, whatever those initials stand for. So,
Council, can I interrupt you? I'm yes, to do that, but your time is limited, and I have some questions I want to make sure I ask. Obviously, the trial court below relied heavily on the state Supreme Court decision in Lloyd.
Yes.
Could you do me a favor and describe, in your view, the Supreme Court's holding in Lloyd and its rationale for its holding?
Yes, I will. Let's jump right to Lloyd and talk about that. I have extensive comments on Lloyd. I'm just going to go right to all those right now.
Well, starting with answering my question about what the holding is and then the rationale for that holding, please.
The precise holding is on page 565 of the opinion, where the court concluded, quote, when an employee brings suit under the whistleblower statute seeking relief for injuries covered by section 24-10-103, compliance with the notice of claim provision of the Immunity Act is necessary. And the reason it said that was, earlier on page 564, it talks about, quote, so long as the procedural requirements of the Immunity Act are satisfied, whistleblower claims will not be barred. The reason it said that was they decided that the whistleblower claims would not be frustrated by the purpose of the notice statute. So they kind of backed their way into that. The real fact of the matter, as we submitted in the brief,
in your view, why did the Supreme Court conclude that the Immunity Act applied at all? Because it only applies to claims
I can
tort,
tell you
right?
What I think and what I conclude from it. They were focused on the notice provision of the Immunity Act, 2410-109. The very first sentence of that act leaves them room to do that. The very first sentence concerns me about that because it says, very broadly, any person claiming to have suffered an injury by a public entity or by an employee thereof while in the course of such employment, shall file written notice. So it's very, very broad. The next sentence then ties it into, and therefore any claim against the government, under the Governmental Immunity Act, must have notice. But that first sentence leaves it very broadly.
But wasn't there a prior sentence, which is to say that the General Assembly intended this Immunity Act to apply to claims that are tort or could lie in tort? Isn't that the beginning of the analysis?
I don't think it's the beginning of the analysis, and let me tell you why. When the they go there and they want to incorporate and sort of just meld the two together. But really, when the issue was briefed, as we submitted to you and provided you with the briefs focused only on the notice issue, because the purpose of the notice issue is so that the governmental entity can investigate the facts and have early notice of what's going on, and so they have full understanding of what the facts are, so when litigation is filed, they'll be ready for it, maybe even resolve it early without litigation. But if you look at the Legislative Council submission to the legislature that gave them the Immunity Act that they eventually passed, and we shared this material with you, what that Legislative Council said was it accepted, it said, quote, at page 132 of the council's report, public entities are immune unless they are declared to be liable by other statutory provision. And so I think what you have to do is look at the purpose of the act and the Immunity Act for one thing, and the purpose of the act and the Whistleblower Act, and compare what they are and see if you can and reconcile them and harmonize them so that they each meet their purpose. The purposes are very different. The purpose of the Governmental Immunity Act is to protect the government from the acts of the employees, save the taxpayer money, protect the government. The purpose of the Whistleblower Act is the reverse. It's to protect the employee from the acts of the government. If you think about it, that's exactly what it is. Because the Whistleblower Act wants to allow the employee to act for the good of the government and carrying out his job.
So it seems like you're arguing, if I understand you correctly, that these are all good reasons why the Immunity Act should not apply to whistleblower claims. Right? That's basically the point. And didn't the Supreme Court decide otherwise in Lloyd? Because if the Supreme Court agreed with you, they would not have applied the notice of claim provision of the Immunity Act, correct?
Well, let me give you several responses to that might address your concerns. First of all, I think after they decide the notice provision applies, the notice statute 2410-109, the rest of it is dicta. Interestingly, if you read the Supreme Court opinion and compare it to other opinions that address the same issue, there are really good arguments for the reverse side. For example, Judge Metzger in the Court of Appeals opinion in Lloyd, Judge Mularkey in the Lloyd dissent, the court in the Antonopoulos case, you can easily make an argument to the exact reverse of the result in Lloyd. I think Lloyd is the outlier. But
we are, of course, bound by Lloyd, right?
Well, you're not necessarily bound by Lloyd if you conclude in looking at it that it really was a very narrow holding and it expanded beyond that in dicta, which I think you can readily do because it only was looking at the notice statute, quite frankly.
Counsel, excuse me, but are there any other cases the appellate courts have applied CGIA to only a single provision of it to a particular type of claim? You're asking us to pull out, you're saying what the Supreme Court did was pull out a single clause and say that applies, right. But under your position, nothing else does. Can you cite to us any other cases where that's been done?
I can't think of one off the top of my head. I'm thinking about the Connors case where they concluded that other statutory claims that aren't arising out of the CGA, out of the Governmental Immunity Act, aren't subject to it. So, in our case, there is not a notice problem. Nobody has a notice problem anymore because you comply with the notice problem. But if you really look, it says there's not a reason to apply other statutory claims to the Governmental Immunity Act. There really aren't. If footnote 6 in the Lloyd case acknowledges that there are all these other statutory claims that can be brought outside the Governmental Immunity Act, and the notice provision may be separate because it's saying, well, we want to have notice of this. And if you read If you compare, let me come back to the point I was going to make. If you read the Supreme Court opinion in Lloyd and you read the facts, it sounds like it was a righteous decision. Like this is the right, this was really right because of the way the facts were. There's no problem with the resolution we're making in this case. But if you take and compare that recitation of the facts by the Supreme Court to the recitation of the facts by Judge Metzger in the Court of Appeals opinion, you come to a really different conclusion. Judge Metzger puts the facts in the opinion in a much different way that make it look like the reverse result that she came to, that the notice statute didn't apply, was really the right case and a righteous result because the plaintiff deserved recovery in that case. The way those facts are treated in those two cases are very different, and maybe that's part of the explanation for why they went the way they did in the Lloyd case, which I still submit to you as an outlier case if you look at the opinions that have looked at this, because they tried to make it look like the right result. And if you look at Judge Metzger's opinion, it doesn't look so righteous. So I don't know if that quite touches.
We frequently have that problem.
I'm sure that's true.
Walton, where we have facts one way and the Supreme Court sees it different.
Well, everybody wants to think that the result they're reaching is the right one, so they grab those facts. I understand that. Thank you. Any other follow-up? Does that address some of your concerns?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, you sure?
Actually, since your time is running out, can I ask you about your second claim, your equal protection
sure.
claim? As far as I understand your claim, I think you're asserting that if the damage provisions of the Immunity Act applies to a civil action under the Whistleblower Act, then an exempt employee such as your client does not have access to the same relief as a classified employee. Is that what you're saying? Is that the disparate treatment that you were talking about at the heart of your equal protection claim?
Right. It's a little different, and you raise a really interesting issue because in that provision that Representative Pena added that provides the damage relief to give exempt employees the same relief that anyone would get as a litigator in district court, there's that added clause on the end of it. It says, and any other such relief as the court deems appropriate. So I read that, I scratch my head, and I think, well, the damages are there because that person is gone. It's not like he's within the personnel system, and they can erase everything and go back to where that person was before. Take out the bad supervisor review, chastise the supervisor, give the money back, put him right back where he was before. That doesn't happen with the exempt employee because he's gone, because he's terminated. But I think that the court can reach into some of those provisions under that last sentence that says, provides equitable relief, essentially, that says, and such other relief as the court can allow. So I think it has to be different.
So do you think a exempt employee filing suit under 105 can obtain equitable relief from the court?
I don't know. Maybe so. But it's not the same as for the classified employees. Clearly that's the case, because the loss is the damages. And if the damages are capped, then it's not the same. If the damages aren't capped.
Well, I'm saying if you don't know whether or not the equitable relief is available, what is the basis of your claim that the two employees are treated differently?
Because instead of getting paid back and getting the same position back and getting all the pay reinstated so the person's in the same place, the exempt employee is gone and is out looking for a job and is unemployed and is now stigmatized by the termination and by filing litigation, so the damages have to be paid. Now, that's fine, but if the damages are capped, he's getting 1 year's worth of salary, and then he's done.
But counsel,
the intent of the statute is frustrated. I'm sorry.
Excuse me, counsel. Aren't you arguing that the disparate treatment is that the classified employees get these equitable remedies, and the other employee and your client does not? That's the disparate treatment.
Yes.
If you're asking for a remedy, I mean, the remedy that normally one would ask for under those circumstances in an equal protection case is, let my client have those remedies. You haven't asked for that. Instead, you've said, create a special super category for people like my client where they get unlimited damages for football coaches, college presidents, deans, and the like, but firemen, policemen, nurses are stuck with a cap. And so, I mean, isn't that kind of the turning the equal protection clause on its head?
I don't think so at all. I'm not sure how you got there. The damages are the real damages that the person has sustained. I don't know that there's anything unrealistic about that or different about that
But a fireman could have damages of more than $150,000, couldn't he?
The question is whether they were entitled to relief under the Whistleblower Act. If they were subjected to that, remember, the purpose of the Whistleblower Act, as set forth in the first section, is to be sure that the employees are insured from not being subjected to injuries and damages by way of discrimination and harassment, to ensure that. So if he's terminated and is capped off after 1 year, he's not been insured of that. The purpose of the statute is frustrated. So I think that's essentially what I'm saying, is that you have to give them the damages that they've sustained by the very purpose of the statute in Section 1. Is that responsive to your question?
Well, it doesn't answer the question why the relief. If the disparate treatment is the different remedies, why are you asking for something different? You're not saying, give me the same remedies that these classified employees.
You're asking
for something different.
I'm asking for the relief that the statute provides to put the person back where to be made whole in the different way that the classified employees are made whole. The statute provides for damages. I'm just saying if it's capped, that frustrates the intent of the statute. It shouldn't be capped.
And won't we face wouldn't there be an equal protection argument on behalf of people who are stuck with a cap? Wouldn't they have an equal protection argument then?
Well, if they're filing a claim under the Whistleblower Act, they're not going to be capped. If they have other claims, that's different. I'm just talking about the Whistleblower Act, which specifically states...
So your position is that classified employees are not subject to the cap, is that?
If you read the formula, they don't get damages. It's a very different, very spelled out process.
Yes, they do.
They get reimbursed. They get put back where they were before.
Well, if the board concludes that there was not a violation, then they can bring suit in court just like your client can.
Sure, they could, yeah.
And you're saying there's no cap under those circumstances?
Right. I am saying that.
Okay.
I wanted to reserve a couple of minutes.
Sorry.
May I anyway?
Unfortunately, no. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Judge Miller, I'm going to answer your question, if I might. A classified employee who is unsuccessful before the personnel board, and they have to go to the personnel board first, can then file suit. They're in the exact same position as an exempt employee, and any whistleblower claim they raise is capped also. So that takes me back to the start of the questions from Judge Navarro about the Lloyd case, because the Lloyd case is what the Supreme Court has told us about whistleblower claims in the interplay with the Immunity Act. The Lloyd case held that whistleblower claims are subject to the Immunity Act. Now, the rationale was, your other question, I believe, the rationale was that that's because whistleblower claims are tort claims. And they went into a discussion of why they thought that and what they understood from the details of the legislation, but that was the bottom line rationale. That a whistleblower claim is a tort claim, therefore it's subject to the Immunity Act, and therefore, because Dr. Lloyd had failed to file a notice of claim, his claim was barred. Now, Mr. Mitchell in his briefs has tried to argue, well, that case only says that the notice of claim provision has to be complied with by a whistleblower claimant. Well, that doesn't make any sense, and it's not what the Lloyd case says. And again, I'm picking on Judge Navarro because it's what I believe you were quoting from or referring to in the case. Because what the Lloyd Court did was it analyzed the Immunity Act and the Whistleblower Act, and then it said that after their review and comparison, and I quote, "This strongly suggests that the General Assembly intended whistleblower actions to be subject to the provisions of the Immunity Act," page 563. They didn't limit that. Wouldn't make any sense, and that's just not what they held.
Let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Wells.
Certainly.
Are you aware of any other any cases where any of this court or the Supreme Court has held that only a specific provision of the Immunity Act applies to a particular category of claim?
No.
So it's your position, Mr. Temple, that once the decision is made in the context of the CGIA, that this is a tort claim or could be a tort claim, the entirety of the CGIA applies?
Absolutely. This is a statutory tort. And that analysis was confirmed in the Farrell case. In the Farrell case, a division of this court held that the Trinity hearing procedure, which is set forth at 2410-108, that's another provision of the Immunity Act, that that provision applies to whistleblower claims. The plaintiff in that case tried to argue, well, there shouldn't have been a Trinity hearing. And the court said, no, the Immunity Act applies to whistleblower claims, and therefore the Trinity hearing procedure applies. We now have two appellate courts applying two different provisions of the Immunity Act to whistleblower claims. There's simply no logic and no legal support for the proposition, I'm answering my question again, for parsing out one provision of the Immunity Act and saying, well, that applies, but nothing else does. And again, that's simply not what Lloyd says. And I think it's also important to note that our legislature knows what you all are doing up on the bench. And when they don't like what the courts do with respect to statutory interpretations, they're not reluctant to amend the statutes. We cited in our brief, I may not pronounce this right, but the Antonopoulos decision, where the court held that police officers weren't subject to the Immunity Act provisions when they made claims under the Police Officers Act. And the legislature amended that statute promptly and said, yes, those claims are. If you make a claim against a police officer under that statute, you've got to comply with the Government Immunity Act. Closer to home, here at CU, back in 1984, the Supreme Court in the Uberi case said that the Open Records Act doesn't apply to CU because of the definitions in the statute. Well, less than a year later, the legislature said, we're changing that. Open Records Act applies to CU. So my point is that Lloyd was decided 25 years ago. The CGIA, or the Government Immunity Act, has been amended 5 times since Lloyd, and they haven't, you know, responded to the Lloyd decision. They've addressed other provisions. And just as an anecdote on that, literally this week, the legislature is expected to amend the Immunity Act again and raise the caps. So when the legislature thinks that the Immunity Act needs to be changed in response to appellate decisions, they do so, and they've done so. Mr. Mitchell argues that the cap is unfair, and I suppose that depends on where you sit. To a claimant, that may be very true. That was certainly true to all of the people that were on the bus on Berthoud Pass. And there was a lot of conversation about changes that should be made to the Immunity Act, and some were. But that's up to the legislature to do. What the legislature has done and what they've explained is what the reason for this cap is. And it's because of the public policy reason of preserving the public fisc. Now, we can agree with that, we can disagree with that, we can think that the cap should be something else, but that's a legislative decision. Turning to the equal protection argument. If there's no suspect classification, and there isn't here, the equal protection analysis has two steps. First, does the legislative scheme treat similarly situated people differently? Second, is there a rational basis for the difference in treatment? Well, on both of those scores, Mr. Mitchell's argument should not prevail. First of all,
Can I interrupt you quickly?
Yes.
There's sort of an intermediate step that you didn't mention, which is whether there is disparate treatment. Do you agree there is disparate treatment between classified employees and exempt employees? And if so, what is that difference?
Well, yes, there's a difference in terms of how classified employees are treated under the Whistleblower Act and how professional exempt employees are treated. Professional exempt employees, if they believe there's been a violation of the Whistleblower Act, have as a remedy to go to district court.
And in that action, can they get equitable relief?
Yes.
Such as reinstatement, for example?
Well, that starts to raise a tougher question, because it would be our position that no remedy could be provided by a district court if the impact on the public fisc exceeded the cap. So that's how I'm going to answer that question. But I think something else, and I think it was raised by Judge Miller, is that Mr. Mitchell in this lawsuit has never requested equitable relief. His amended complaint asks for monetary damages, and that's what this case has always been about. And he wants more than the cap, and that's why we're here. So, my first argument is that professional exempt employees and classified employees are not similarly situated. So we don't even get to the second prong of the equal protection analysis. Why aren't they similarly situated? Well, that just speaks to what the state personnel system is all about. The state personnel system starts with our Constitution, and then goes down to several legislative enactments, and then goes down to 100 pages or so of state personnel board regulations. And they all speak to how we treat employees in the classified system. So, and those have to do with everything from hiring to evaluations to compensation and to discipline. At length, they address all those issues, but only for classified employees. Professional exempt employees don't have those protections, and in some cases don't have those burdens, but they're simply not similarly situated employees.
Are you aware, counsel, of any case that has held or considered whether classified employees are similarly situated to exempt employees in this state?
No, and I'm quite confident that there is no such case. But speaking of cases, last Thursday, a division of this court issued a decision in United Airlines versus Jones. And that decision was authored by Judge Webb. And in that case, United Airlines argued that a section of the of the workers' compensation statute violated equal protection, because the cap on recovery for workers' compensation claimants applied differently to persons in different situations. And really that had to do with, and I'm gonna get way out of my field here trying to talk about workers' compensation, but if depending on how long it takes a person to recover before they're determined, they have the evaluation for maximum recovery, they may get temporary benefits that exceed the $75,000 cap, and United wanted that money back. And the Court of Appeals said, no. First, you're not similarly situated. And they made that finding even though we were talking about two employees, both with workers' compensation claims, both with similar injuries, but they said they're not similarly situated because they may not recover from their injuries at the same rate. Now, they went on to find that there was also a rational basis. But my point here is that those employees in that United Airlines case sound an awful lot more similarly situated than what we've got here. So we'd ask the court to reject Mr. Mitchell's argument for that reason. But secondly, the rational basis. What is the rational basis for why professional exempt employees are treated differently? Well, I think it's a premise of Mr. Mitchell's argument that professional exempt employees have less rights, and that's not clear. Not to me, it's not. Professional exempt employees can go directly to district court and can seek, in our view, up to $150,000 in damages. Before the personnel board, a classified employee can't get any damages.
But the classified employee can get reinstatement, if the effect of that reinstatement is the imposition of more than $150,000 on the state.
That's true, but as a practical matter, that will never happen, because a classified employee has to file their appeal within 10 days of the disciplinary action. Then they're required to have a hearing within, I think it's 60 days, and I know it's not more than 90 days, and the administrative law judge has to issue a decision within 40 days. Under those timetables and given the kinds of salaries that our classified employees make, there would never be a case where you'd get to $150,000. But you're absolutely right.
Okay, and I understand that correctly. You're saying that the monetary relief in whatever form available to a classified employee in the administrative system is probably or never going to be more than $150,000.
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
And so, again...
But it could be more if the board or ALJ, whatever, denied and said there was no violation. Person then brings a lawsuit that goes on for several years. It could approach the cap, couldn't it?
Well, in that situation, if the classified employee files a lawsuit in district court, they have the exact same remedies that a professional exempt employee is. They no longer have their personnel board remedies. Before the personnel board, they can get things, unusual kinds of remedies, like orders that their supervisor be disciplined. Well, that's not a remedy the court can order. It's unique to the personnel board. So they no longer can get the personnel board remedies, but they can get the remedies they can get in district court. And that does include compensatory damages up to $150,000. So the rational basis simply, again, speaks to what the purpose of the personnel system is all about. The purpose of the state personnel system is to ensure that our classified employees are given a whole set of rights and that they're able to, they make a decision to work for the state. They sometimes get paid a whole lot less, but they get a lot of protections. And they make that choice, and all those rights having to do with their hiring, their compensation, their rights to grievances, and the like, are provided starting with the Constitution, going down through the state statutes, and then to the state personnel board regulations. And so we believe that there is certainly a rational basis for the fact that very specific remedies are provided to classified employees, both in the state personnel system as a whole and in the Whistleblower Act. Court has no more questions. I'm done.
Mr. Temple, let me ask you a question. You cited the United Airlines versus Jones case. That was not cited in your brief. Couldn't have been, obviously.
No, Your Honor.
All right. It's our practice to allow opposing counsel to respond just to that case. So, Mr. Welton, if you desire to, only if you desire to, you're permitted to send a letter, not to exceed 2 pages, directed to the three of us, not to the court, but to the three of us, please, explaining why you think that case does not apply.
Thank you so much. It gives me some element of response. I appreciate it. I'm sitting here wanting to respond, so thank you so much.
All right, that concludes the arguments this afternoon. This case will likewise stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.
What kind of a time frame if I may interrupt for the letter?
I would like you to get it in within 5 days.
Thank you so much.
That's fine. All right. That concludes our docket for the afternoon. We will be in recess, and the bailiff may announce that. We would ask the council, if you would please, to remain and answer questions from the students. We're going to take about 15 or 20 minutes ourselves, and we'll be back at that time as well. Court will be in recess.
Court is in recess, subject to call.